It's 7:14 a.m. You're listening to Upfront. Earlier this month, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change issued a report showing how dangerously close we are to exhausting the Earth's resources. Governments may not be heeding that warning, but the people who live and work next to oil refineries and massive power plants have been creating their own solutions. Here's Michelle Macarena-Swan. She's a member of the Movement Generation Staff Collective and part of the Our Power campaign. We're living in a time where we're seeing the consequences of the economic system that we've created. We're seeing massive ecological destruction, an economic system that's producing a lot more stuff, but fewer jobs. How is the Our Power campaign responding?
A few years ago, communities across the U.S. and really North America began to get together through the Climate Justice Alliance. These communities have been getting together both to take on the extreme energy problems in there, the sources of extreme energy that are cited often in working class communities and communities of color.
For example,
right here in Richmond, California, we have the Chevron refinery, which is one of the most polluting facilities in the state. It's actually trying to expand to refine dirtier and dirtier grades of crude oil as the cheap, sweet, light crude that this industrial system was built on becomes harder and harder to obtain. Energy companies are going to further and further lengths to extract fossil fuels and other kinds of energy sources from the planet. And so we have things like the massive oil spill that happened in the Gulf a few years ago due to deep water drilling. We have, you know, tremendous impacts of tar sands extraction in Alberta and, you know, British Columbia that mostly land on the indigenous communities who earn their livelihood from the land, you know, and so they're seeing their land base totally destroyed in order to continue to go to greater depths to obtain energy to fuel this system. And so these communities are seeing these things first and worse, you know, they're being hit. And at the same time, they have been actually generating the kinds of solutions that are necessary to meet their needs with very low resources, monetary resources, but a lot of social resources. So
what are some of those solutions?
You know, the solutions are often in the form of things that collectivize our resources and support us in actually sharing our labor rather than our labor being extracted and used as a chainsaw almost against the Earth's systems. How can we band together to collectively meet our needs in ways that care for place?
So what would an example of that be?
So energy. If we just think about shifting the energy systems from extreme energy to community-based clean energy, this means not only how it's produced, but who owns it, and also what it's used for, right? We can't simply transition from this massive industrial energy to smaller scale renewable energy sources without actually addressing what we're using it for, right? So it means retooling the whole the food system, the water system, public transit, for example, shifting from single passenger vehicles to public transit, from industrial scale waste systems that put our trash out in landfills and burn them in incinerators to shifting to zero waste solutions. And these communities have been in the forefront of developing these solutions and finding that actually they not only produce less greenhouse gas emissions, less pollution that causes harms people's health, but they also produce more jobs.
One of the solutions that we saw advanced, especially in the last 4 years, to address some of the concerns around health, maybe not around corporate ownership, but certainly around health and environment, was the idea of green jobs. Mm. How is what you're calling for different from the call for green jobs that we were seeing?
To us, to the Climate Justice Alliance and this campaign that we're launching, the Our Power campaign, it's really about transition. I think that green jobs was seized as the moment provided an opportunity. People need jobs. People need to pay their rent, and the economy is clearly failing us. And there's this opening, seemingly from this crisis, this ecological crisis that we also know we face. And so it seemed like, oh, here's a great solution. We can provide jobs while meeting the need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and go green. But unfortunately, that path really was paved by mostly kind of corporate interests and really went in the direction of continued concentration and control of the resources. And that, we think, is not going to solve the fundamental root cause of the climate crisis or of the fundamental crisis of people's livelihoods. As long as we have social inequity, the system will continue to be out of balance. You can't have ecological balance when you have a social inequity. And so the economic system that we have to transition into must provide workers, those who are putting their labor on the line, with democratic control of how that labor is being applied. And of course, communities need to be very much participating also in those decision-making processes. Green jobs really didn't address those fundamental issues of democratization and decentralization. This is really charting a new path.
And with any new path, especially given the economic system that we live in, doesn't it require some level of either capital or government funding or government support?
So there absolutely has to be a resource shift. There has to be a shift from the 1% to building the infrastructure that destruction that's been caused by the 1% for the last 250 years plus to provide a pathway for transition. The reality is that we're in a transition. And who is positioned to lead that transition will determine both where it ends up and what it looks like along the way. Right now, we're kind of on a path, unfortunately, without social movements stepping up, and especially racial and economic justice movements rooted in communities of color, rooted in working class communities. If we don't step up to lead it, the resources will continue to be concentrated and controlled in ways that are used to really just build the lifeboats for the 1%, while the rest of us are shut out. And we'll see increasing levels of climate migration. We already know there's not enough water in LA and Arizona and the Southwest. What are those people going to do? What is the infrastructure that is being funded? Yeah, it needs to be resourced in order to retool our water systems so that we can slow it, spread it, and sink it instead of paving, piping, and polluting it. There are different mechanisms, funding mechanisms, that folks are looking at right now. There is something called the Robin Hood tax, the financial transaction tax, to shift financing from, you know, stock market trading to get a small percentage of each transaction for basic services, cuts that have been made to services that we are able to reinvest in those things, and also address transition and climate debt for the global south.
So in terms of how we get from where we are today to the place of transitioning to the system that you're talking about, if it's going to require public resources and it's going to require governmental bodies and politicians to make these decisions, then does the road that we need to walk at this point, is that a road of lobbying?
So what it looks like is actually building the new in the shards of the old, you know? So even while we're in this system, we are actually developing the new models. And that means winning policy. It means building the new economic institutions like cooperatives, like different kinds of public sector employment, you know, that actually invest people in that work of transition. And it means, yes, shifting the resources. It's everything from the kind of things that the city of Richmond is doing right now to stop foreclosures and stop getting people moved out of their homes, right? We think that people staying in place is actually essential to people being able to take care of place, right? When you have constant forced migration of peoples, that people aren't able then to settle and be able to figure out, like, well, where does the creek flow and what kind of food does grow in this climate here? What are the needs of our community, right? And so setting roots is really essential to this transition.
Can we talk a little bit then about some of the other elements of just transition that you're seeing in Richmond?
Folks have been really fighting the bad acting that Chevron has done in that community, you know, for over a century. And it's only in the past decade that folks have really been able to turn the tables and retake control of governance in the city. And as we saw last year, that was so crucial. It was critical that the people of Richmond had folks on the city council and in the office of the mayor to stand up to Chevron when the explosion happened and the fire broke out last year. So many people were sent to the hospital sick, and so many others didn't know that they had been contaminated and affected, right? And so that's one part of it, is really just people retaking governance. The second part of it is retaking economy. So it means transitioning to local living economies that can foster community resilience. What community members are doing is really looking at what would it take to retool our energy system and shift to community scale, you know, solar, wind, you know, what are the other forms of energy? You know, Richmond is an amazing site of folks retaking the food system and putting in place local urban agriculture that's actually engaging neighbors block to block, you know, and getting back out there and talking to each other over a garden plot. Water systems are another, and that looks like gray water, you know, retooling our plumbing system so that our washing machines don't just unload into the sewer.
Is there a limit to the types of solutions you're talking about just based on scale? For example, with energy, a lot of what's said is we can't meet our energy needs through solar and wind.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And that's why we need things like natural gas mm-hmm. or nuclear.
It's easy for people to say that when they don't live next door to the nuclear plant and they don't live next door to the site that's being fracked. But the reality is that no community, we believe that no community is expendable. You know, we're not willing to say that your community must provide the energy to fuel the rest of the world or the rest of the state. And so it does look like a shifting of the whole economy. It's not just about looking at energy and how can we continue to meet this growing demand for energy, because it is still growing, right? Even though we're saying, oh, there's a climate problem, people, and we have to shift our energy use. That's not happening, right? We still see the demand curves are going up. And so what we're saying, it's actually about retooling the economy. It's about all of the systems together.
And shifting our values, too.
That's right.
I mean, the idea that no one is expendable is definitely not a part of the economic framework or values framework that's promoted.
What's so beautiful about this moment is that it provides an opportunity for all of us to live out what's really in our hearts. As humans, we're not really meant to be individualistic and to look away when someone has a need, but we're forced to do that every day because we can't possibly take on all of the problems that this system has created. I think the opportunity is that we actually find ways to meet our own needs collectively that shift us out of this individualistic system, and instead we become the midwives of the transition.
Is this a middle class movement? Just some of the things that you were talking about, being able to grow food together or rework your plumbing system in terms of how you do gray water, a lot of that may require being a homeowner, for example, mm-hmm. and having access to the kind of capital that it takes in order to own land, mm-hmm. Which is especially in the Bay Area a lot, or even in terms of time, you know, the time and energy that it takes for people to engage in some of these local living economy solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is that a lot of people who don't have middle class jobs are incredibly squeezed for all of those things, right? For money, time, and energy.
Right. I think it's actually not true that most of this is happening is in middle class communities, I think, or that is happening. But I think working class communities actually do tons of collective work to collectivize things like childcare and food production, you know, sharing meals with each other, helping each other out because they don't have paid sick time. So there's always a grandmother or an auntie or a relative that will help pick the kid up when from school when you're sick. I think there's been really important ways that folks have developed these mutual aid kind of mechanisms. And I think we're in a moment where through organizing, we can actually begin to build the kind of vehicles and infrastructure for people to scale that up.
That was Michelle Macarena Swan giving us some insight into the Our Power campaign.